Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Right Lane, a podcast of the Tampa Bay Times and the Poynter Institute. On this podcast, Times reporter Lane DeGregory discusses her stories and answers your questions. The focus is on craft. My name is Maria Carrillo, and I'm a former enterprise editor at the Times. Today's topic, what is a feature story? The Society for Features Journalism recently hosted a conversation between Lane and New York Times writer Eli Saslow. Saslow won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing with a series of narratives about people's lives and struggles 3 years into the pandemic. Lane was a Pulitzer judge in that category. They talk about how to define feature writing these days, given how open-ended the Pulitzer category has become. Thanks to SFJ for letting us use the recording for the Right Lane podcast. Have a listen.
All right. Well, hello there, everybody. Welcome to this very special Society for Features Journalism event. My name is Laura Coffey, and I am the vice president of SFJ. And the whole SFJ board is so happy that you could all join us today for this discussion between two of the greatest feature writers of all time. No exaggeration. That's Lane DeGregory and Eli Saslow. Lane and Eli are both recipients of the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Lane actually served as a Pulitzer judge for feature writing, the feature writing category this year. And so today she's going to give us all a little behind the scenes glimpse into the kinds of discussions that the Pulitzer judges needed to have this year in order to define in a very fundamental way, you know, what a feature story even is anymore.
It's something we've talked about in our newsroom a little bit. Talked about in journalism classes a little bit, but I don't think there's ever been like a real full-blown discussion about what is a feature story. So I wanted to, which is kind of interesting, right? So I wanted to start out with a little bit of background. Feature writing was only added as a category to the Pulitzer Prizes in 1979. The prizes themselves started in 1917. So it's a new category for us. I didn't really know it was a separate category until I had already gotten into doing this for a little while. But it's definitely changed in the last, I don't know, what is that, 30 something years since they made this category. The idea of a feature story has changed. I also think that it changed in 2016 a lot when they opened it up to magazine writing. Right. And all of a sudden, newspaper writers are competing against The Atlantic and The New Yorker and all these things that we aspire to, but we don't have that time and resources that a lot of those magazines do. So I wanted to read a definition of the Pulitzer Prize feature writing category and also point out that features and editorial writing are the only two of all the categories in the Pulitzer Prizes that have writing in the title, as opposed to reporting, which I think, I don't know what that means, but I think it was an interesting distinction. And their very brief definition is, for distinguished feature writing, giving prime consideration to quality of writing, originality, and concision using any available journalistic tool. Now, Eli, you were one of hundreds of people who entered this competition, this category. You were one of probably a dozen that rose very, very, very quickly to the top of the pile. But then we had a whole big discussion about what your work was doing. I kind of think what my work is doing too is traditional feature writing versus all these other types of writing that we're getting entered into our category this year. So I want to ask you, first of all, how would you define a feature story? If you got to rewrite the thing for the Pulitzers, what would you say?
Yeah, thanks, Lane. One of the things I love about the feature writing category, I guess feature writing in general, is that I do think it's remarkably diverse. I mean, there are stories that are more first person that fit into that category. This year, like Beautiful Work, that I would say was like a little bit more essayistic. I agree with you, Lane, that I think of my own stories is a little bit more conventionally narrative. But I would say basically a feature story to me, like most broadly, is a story that is going to make me care about somebody and feel something. And a story where I'm not only going to be learning about the facts around a situation, but I'm going to be meant to feel something more human. And often that means a story where the beginning and the end of the story are different. Something there's been action and something has changed, whether that's like you've deepened your understanding about a person's psychology, or whether like more conventionally events in the story have transpired and you end up at a different point than you've begun. So to me, like feature stories should involve more of a journey where you're ending at a very different spot from where you've begun, and you've learned something along the way that's like deepened your knowledge, but also deepened how you feel about the person or the thing that you're reading about.
That's so interesting, because the idea of like growth or an emotional arc or even rising and falling action, that never came into any of our discussions we had around that table at Columbia, you know, and I think
that's probably why I've never been a judge.
No, I hope you are. I really hope you are. I mean, that's one thing I also should say, and Laura and I talked about this a little bit. Out of the judges on that category, I was the only one who was a writer. Everybody else was editors, you know, from like a myriad of different publications. So we all had different, really different ideas. You know, we had people from a New York Times business editor, historian from Durham, North Carolina, the editorial director of the project, The 19th, an editor at Politico, at The New Yorker, and then a sports guy. So, you know, it was like a very big, diverse panel, but nobody talked about emotion. And I wonder if the title was human interest rather than feature, if that might change the landscape a little bit, because I'm completely on board with you in terms of like, if my story doesn't make somebody cry or feel something, then I feel like I failed. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's such an important part.
Yeah. And I think, like, you know, for all of us who care about this kind of work, it's the stories that we feel that stick with us, right? I mean, that's, I think in a lot of ways, that's how I've landed on how I do journalism, which is often like looking at what are the big tension points in the country? What are like the big fissures that matter in big ways? And how can I take these big issues and make them feel personal in ways that like hopefully illuminate them in a new way? And that's, you know, in those stories, you're hoping that you're connecting like the big issue, the big thing that's happening, something that is urgent and of the moment, with like an intimate like view into somebody who's experiencing that, right? And if you can do both of those things, then maybe you've made somebody feel something, and also you've made them feel something that will change the way they think about the big thing. Like that's often how I think about my own work.
And you mentioned this at the beginning there, that there's a lot, I think, it's a lot more first person pieces and essay pieces that are being entered in this category these days than in the past. I mean, there have been first person ones that won before, but since the magazines joined the crowd, it's been a whole lot more in terms of that direction. Do you ever feel tempted, I guess, or that you want to put yourself in a piece, that you want to include you as a narrator or the man discovering this?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And the honest answer is no. I mean, I know that like, if I was writing first person pieces that were about me, they wouldn't be nearly as interesting as the people that I'm writing about. But also, like, you know, I think where we see first person sometimes used effectively in feature stories, particularly in magazine stories, and in one of the stories that was a finalist this year is yeah, somebody inserting themselves almost as like the guide or the narrator to connect a story. For me, the reason that I'm often writing stories that unfold almost entirely in dialogue and scene is that I'm doing whatever I can, I hope, to create like a very direct interaction between the reader and the person that they're reading about. And the way that that happens is if my presence is not felt, right? Like ideally in the type of like scene and dialogue driven narrative feature stories that I'm writing, it almost feels to a reader like you're being brought up to a clear pane of glass, and you're watching the events of the story unfold for yourself. You're hearing the person that you're reading about have conversations with the people that they love or the people that they care about, not with a reporter. You're seeing them, you know, go from the rehab back home and the first day in the garage and what that's like. And I think, like, if you create that kind of direct interaction, almost like a really good documentary or a movie or a good piece of fiction, it feels to the reader like they've seen something and understood something for themselves. And so the conclusions that they draw feel like their own, not like something that they've been told to think or told to, you know, surmise from something. And that's, I think those are the conclusions for all of us that are the most meaningful and most long lasting, the ones that we feel like we've witnessed something, it's changed how we feel, it's impacted us in some way. So to me, I think like There are many writers who do that beautifully by inserting themselves a little bit more as the narrator and as the tour guide. I think sometimes I hope the power in the stories that I'm writing is that when people are reading them, other than a very select few people who are generous enough to be here in this chat, most people are not thinking about me. But I hope they're not thinking about how the story's written. They're thinking about the people that I'm writing about. And that's how I want it.
I love that. I agree with everything you said there, because I think the power to me of having somebody read your work is immersing them in someone else's world, you know, not taking them by the hand and going, come with me, I'm going to show you something.
Totally.
But like you said, a couple of the, one of the other finalists, actually both of the other finalists in your category this year, one of them was the woman who had followed this woman for 10 years on her journey to prove whether or not she actually had been sexually assaulted. She helped her try to figure this mystery out and was there the whole time for 10 years. The other one was a woman who took on the death row cases in Alabama, and she basically became a party to a lawsuit to try to change things. So she was really involved. And some of the people on my judges panel didn't even think those should be finalists, you know, because they didn't fit the definition of a feature. They were wonderful. They were richly reported, totally one, you know, beautifully told and written. But was that a feature story, right? Like if you become involved in it, or if you become the subject of it, does that count as a feature story? Do you think those belong in that category? Or what would you do with those as a judge?
Yeah. I mean, I guess in general, I think what I care about as a journalist is big, ambitious, meaningful work. And both of those other finalists were certainly that, right? And so the last thing that I would want to do would be to craft a definition of feature writing that excludes more things from the tent. Because I think what I care about is journalists being able to do work that's meaningful to them and also hopefully meaningful to the world. And both of those stories certainly qualified. They're very different from what I do, and frankly, very different from what I'd be capable of doing. I think the death penalty work from The Atlantic is some of its power is that it comes from a very clear point of view, right? There's real moral clarity in general in the way that she writes. That's very different from what I'm doing, which I think is much more observed and comes from, I think, more of a place of certainly not remove. The stories I hope are very intimate, but they're not inhabiting my own point of view. And the Boston Globe piece was her role in the story was a very big part of actually what happened in the story. So it was necessarily first person because she was the secondary character in the pieces. And I think it's good for all of us when the definitions for some of this stuff can be a little bit more broad. I think we don't want to exclude things from being considered feature stories, because I think what a feature story signals to a lot of people is this is work that is big and meaningful and that I put a lot of time into. Those are the stories all of us came into journalism to do, and it's why we all care about it. So I like that definition being wide. I mean, also, every year when I when I write stories, at the end of the year, often there's a conversation at the Post of okay, are we going to enter these for a prize? And if so, what category are they going to be in? And it's not always feature writing, right? And when I won for explanatory reporting, those were definitely feature stories. They were the same kind of narrative stories that I write, but they were about one issue that felt to the editors of the Post who decide how to submit these things more explanatory. So, I think having it be a little bit fluid between categories to me is good for all of us, because basically it's just saying we care about meaningful, memorable work, and that can be done in different ways. That's the beauty of journalism.
So with a question from your Australian fan, she wanted to know, a lot of the, and I feel this too as a local reporter, right? A lot of times the hardest part for me is convincing someone to talk to me, convincing them to open up and let me in.
The most complicated thing about this work for I'm sure both of us, Lane, is navigating these really complicated, really intimate relationships with the people that we write about, where it's we're asking a tremendous amount of people and we're not giving them anything in return, right? There's no, obviously nobody's getting paid for being written about, nobody has any control over the thing that's written, nobody is going to see it before it's published in the newspaper. So basically we're approaching people and we're saying, We think what's happening to you matters. We think what you're experiencing matters. We think that your story matters. And like, we're just asking for them to trust us, that we care enough. We're going to be cautious enough. We're going to be kind enough when that's the thing to get it right, you know. And sometimes that also means, I think for both of us, writing about moments in people's lives that are can feel to them shameful or embarrassing or profoundly painful. And those are often the moments that I'm trying to be there for. So part of the conversation with the people that I'm writing about always is sort of saying to them, if you have questions about why I want to see the things I do or why I want to be here in these moments, please ask me. And if there are times when you're uncomfortable, or if there are times when, you know, you're just tired of me like sticking around, just let me know. Like, I'll go grab a coffee. I'll come back later. That's fine. I think part of it is being patient, right? Like, building this kind of trust takes a long time. And for me, it's like the longer that I spend with the people that I'm writing about, the better and like the more true the stories get, right? Like the what somebody tells you in your first conversation is very different than what they tell you in your fifth conversation, because they know you, they feel more comfortable. Trying to think of the stories that were in the Pulitzer package this year, but some of them were much different in that I had a sense of the time frame beforehand. But say for, like, one of the stories was about these Filipino teachers who were being flown in to save a school in Bullhead City, Arizona, which I would say was probably the most meaningful of the four stories to me. It got read the least of those four stories for whatever reason. But I just remember when I was there in the classroom, I felt like I was seeing something that was like really important. I mean, just and mattered a lot to me. Like in that story, I didn't really know. I knew what the starting point was. Like, I'd made a bunch of calls around the country to learn about teacher shortages, and then I'd learned that, like, wow, Arizona is really in rough shape, and all these schools are flying in teachers from the Philippines at the last minute because they don't have anybody else in their classrooms. And then in calling around to all these districts around Arizona, I'd found this 75-year-old superintendent of a failing school district who was missing 40% of her teachers at the start of the school year, and who was going to go drive, you know, this, again, 75-year-old superintendent going to go drive in the middle of the night to go pick up a bunch of Filipino teachers arriving at the airport, arriving to the United States for the first time. And I was like, that's where the story starts, right? This is a beginning. These teachers are showing up, something's going to happen. In that case, I had no idea what would happen. And I thought, maybe I'm going to be following them for 2 months. Like, I don't know I don't know where this will go. I don't know what the ending will be, but it became clear very quickly that these teachers landed believing that they were about to teach like the best and brightest students in the world, in the most functional country in the world, the place that they had been dreaming about their entire lives. And for them, arriving to teach at Bullhead City Middle School was the pinnacle of their career, you know, and they arrived with such like confidence in what America was and such self-belief in their ability to do this and do it well. And that evaporated within the first 2 or 3 days, right? Like, very quickly, it was like, seeing them see what this place was, that was, it became clear that actually, like, that's the important moment. Following them for 2 months is just, it's going to muddy that. Like, what's the transformation, the action had happened really quickly. So sometimes that happens too, where you go in and you don't know where it's going.
Somebody is asking how you found the older woman that you talked to in your 2016 story, who is the election addict addicted to misinformation. And then she was curious about how you watched her. Like, did you look over her shoulder when she was on the computer at home? That kind of asking the how and why question again.
Yeah, sure. So that was a story where, you know, it was like a misinformation, like disinformation, I guess, internet story. And what I learned about first was, as I was looking into like that world of disinformation, was this guy who lived in rural Maine, who, you know, was a Democrat, but believed that like he was going to spread all these ridiculously off the map, like right wing theories on a Facebook page to sort of make fun of people who thought they were true. But of course, it turned out that a ton of people thought that they were true. And this Facebook page became like one of the most like virally powerful things on Facebook. And so this guy in Maine was inventing things like, you know, like basically like Pizzagate, like, can you believe that, you know, Obama and Clinton have these kids in the back of this pizza shop in DC, and tons of people around the country were liking them, commenting on them and believing it was real. So the first trip that I made in that story was to Maine to write about this guy, Chris Blair, who was the creator of all of this disinformation and who was putting these posts up again and again and again. But I realized pretty quickly that that story was not going to feel satisfying unless it felt like there was a back and forth exchange on the other side with some of the, to him, like these anonymous people that were clicking like and commenting on these posts around the country. So I started going through basically just all those Facebook posts after I made this trip to Maine, trying to figure out who's the person on the other side so that I can make this a story that sort of passes from one of these people to another. Like, this person puts up the post and then boom, next section, we're with the person who's reading it and liking it and believing it's true. And then maybe we're back with Chris, and then we're back in this other place. So the sort of character search, I guess, in that story started as just like going through all these Facebook posts and looking at people who are commenting on them. And there were tons of people, but there were like a number of people who would comment on almost everything, including one woman in Nevada who, you know, through Facebook and like, for all of you, like maybe you're already doing this, but Facebook to me is by far the most, it can be very frustrating, but it's the most useful like reporting tool in terms of social sites to me, mostly because Facebook groups are very searchable. You can search through groups pretty easily. And also a lot of people like put a decent amount of themselves on Facebook. So you can sort of get a sense of people pretty quickly. So I started going through all these profile pages, found this woman in Nevada who,
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Who liked everything that this page put out, who often was commenting and posting on it, clearly believing all of it was true. Then through Facebook, reached out to her, started talking to her on the phone. She was definitely like a little skeptical of why, you know, who I was, why I wanted to come, but eventually agreed to meet me. She didn't want me to come to her house. She said, can we meet at this Thai restaurant in rural Nevada? So I flew there. I met her at the Thai restaurant, sort of, you know, hoping and believing that once she met me, she would become more comfortable over the course of an hour and a half lunch or 2 hour lunch. Maybe she would say, okay, sure, you can come back to my house. Like I'll show you these things. And you know, and that's what happened. I stayed there for 2 or 3 days and did sort of sit next to her as she was doing what she does all day, which was like looking at Facebook and then believing that, you know, like the Black Lives Matter movement or whatever boogeyman were in her head was about to take over this like rural Nevada town. So yeah, I went and I sat there with her, which is always what I try to do.
Yeah, that's a great answer. This next question is for both of you. The person wants to know if you have any tips for how, if you're not a feature writer and you want to incorporate more descriptive scenes and dialogue and narrative in everyday beats, what are some things that you would tell people to do?
Wayne, you want to go first?
I mean, I guess the first thing is being there, right? Like, get out and be there. I don't think you can do. I was so frustrated during the pandemic, and I was so impressed with what you did, Eli, because you took the hindrances and made it something that you could use and work within. But I was like, oh, can you like FaceTime me and show me your library? Can you FaceTime me and show me your dog? And it was so unsatisfying to try to like report for narrative without being able to be there in person. So that would be my first tip. And I think Tom French talks about vacuuming the scene, you know, and as a young reporter trying to transist from going to like reporting on meetings or reporting on trials or police or whatever, it was super helpful to go like, look up, what do the lights look like? You know, look around, what does the grass smell like? What does it feel like to hold the frost on the gate, you know, in your hand? And so sensory reporting, I think. And the other thing that I think helped me for a minute was like internal dialogue, like not just watching, not just like asking people what happened, but asking like, what were you feeling? What were you praying for? What were you worrying about? What were you freaking out over? You know, like in trying to get inside their head, I think was a really helpful, tip for me.
Yeah, I'd echo both of those. And I'd also say sometimes when it helps if you're going to get really granular, like with questions, which is one way that you do this. Like, I think, you know, details are basically the heart of so much of this stuff. And so if I'm going to get really granular, like about a particular moment in somebody's life when I'm interviewing them, I'll sometimes say, I know this is going to seem really weird that I want to know like all these really specific things about your morning routine or what it was looking like when you were driving that day, but here's why I'm doing that. It's because I want people to feel it and to understand it. And then, you know, I think that sometimes buys a little bit more patience and makes you feel a little bit less strange and creepy when you're asking the questions. So that helps me. And in terms of like, you know, vacuuming the room, which is a wonderful phrase that I'd never heard before. I think for me, like, that's the one place where like cell phones and other little tools are really helpful. Like when I'm reporting, I'm often taking like just little video scans of a room where I'm in, little you know, photos that are like unpublishable and awful, but will be really helpful to me when I'm going back and I'm writing a scene about that moment. So some of that is useful too.
That's excellent. Here's a question from Bobby Nightingale, who works at my paper, the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Once you begin a story, do you stay with that story until its completion, or do you juggle multiple stories at once? And if you only focus on one at a time, at what point do you realize where it's the end, like where you have to, you know, you have to just write the story or you have to switch topics?
Yeah, I can go first, Lane, and then you can hop in. I mean, in my ideal is that I work on one thing and I am sort of like somewhat obsessed with it until it's done. That's not just the logistics of journalism and building trust and the way stories unfold makes it so that that's not always possible. I mean, right now, you know, the story that I wrote that ran on Sunday, I was working on that story and another story at the same time. And I found it really challenging. But this other story that I'm working on is about somebody who's just so damaged that like he needs time and space, and there's just, it hasn't been as fast as I would like it to be. And sometimes I think part of this is realizing like we're not always in control, and that if you press too hard, that often does not work in your favor. So what about you, Ryan?
I usually have 6 to 10 at once that I'm juggling. I mean, I've got different expectations because I'm doing short little 1,000-word pieces for Sunday, or I'm covering the Pride Parade, or, you know, something happens in the legislature and they're like, oh, go put a face on this, and I've got to turn it around quicker. So I usually have at least 6 up to 10 at a time. And sometimes I have to go to my editor and go, which one do you need? You know, like, what can I really dive in on? Because it's super frustrating. Like, I spent a lot of time at New College this spring. I still haven't written that story because I don't know where it ends, but I haven't been able to go back there because I've had all these other stories. So I relish those times where she's like, just take this week, Lane, you know, just have a week and do this, because often things pull me in other directions.
Yeah. I mean, do you find yourself getting scattered or you're so used to it that you can keep them all sort of on their own separate tracks?
I get pretty scattered. I mean, I can see these are my piles of the 6 I have going on now along here. So each one of them has a pile. I print everything out because I feel like I'm going to lose it electronically otherwise. But the thing to me that's hardest is trying to explain to my sources. Like, I know you spent 12 hours with me yesterday, but I can't talk to you again until Wednesday, because I want them to feel like they're the most important thing in the world. I want them to feel like they're my only story. I think that's important, you know, to shore up your sources and have no distractions so that they feel important, you know, but that sometimes doesn't work out.
Yeah, the demands just creep in. That's amazing though, juggling 6 at once. Here's another question for Lane from Courtney Crowder. My editor was on the local reporting committee, and she said that their guiding principle became impact, the impact of the reporting on the community. What was your committee's guiding principle? Was it narrative and storytelling, or was it access? Did you guys talk about that when you were judging?
I don't know that we came to the one word theme that we're supposed to find before we start to write, you know. We had several Ukraine stories in there about the war. There was discussion about like how important is it that these journalists were risking their lives? You know, one of them was like, well, this one wasn't as well edited, but oh my gosh, the stuff that they got. And I thought, well, that's on the editor's end, right? That's not on the writing end of it. This guy's like holed up in the theater in the middle of Mariupol. Like, what do you want from him? You know? So there was questions about the quality of the writing. There was questions about the access of the reporting, especially when it came down to essays and first person stuff. Like, you don't have to talk yourself into a story that you're already in. You know, you don't have to convince someone to let you in these hard points in your life when you're living them. So that was a discussion. I think the most interesting one that came about maybe on the third day was that last word in the definition that they had, concision, because so many of the stories were like, it took 4 hours to read them, and then there'd be another sidebar, and then there was a podcast that went with it, and then you have to go listen to the after story of what happened. And it was like, it was so daunting, you know, especially by day three as a Pulitzer judge, to have to get through. The one lady was just like, can we go back to this word, concision? So
this is why if I ever am a judge, I want to judge like editorial cartooning. Like, yeah, just right. Much less time consuming.
They couldn't figure out what that was either though, Eli, because they added like graphic novels and graphic things on websites now. So even the editorial cartooning people were like, what are we judging? You know, it was such divergent.
Such a changed world. Yeah. Okay, we have more questions to get through. So I'm going to try to rapid fire you guys. So the next question is a rapid fire. Is Facebook better than LinkedIn? Go.
For me, yes. I have more luck on Facebook than LinkedIn. And the biggest thing for me on Facebook is like the group searches. Like if I know the subject I'm writing about, you know, for instance, if I'm writing about fentanyl and like parents looking for kids who have basically gone missing after starting using fentanyl, there are 16 Facebook groups for that. I can hopefully join them. I can search them. I can look through people's stories. That feature is really helpful to me.
Okay, that's really helpful. Then here's one from Eleanor from Detroit, who is a budding features writer. And she's saying, there are so many ways to tell a story. How did you find your storytelling voice as feature writers? And how did you discover what your strengths were as storytellers? Both of you have such beautiful and distinctive approaches to the work.
But what a nice question. And I think for me, you know, it's largely about reading, right? Like that's how, I think that's how I've figured out like how to do this, and hopefully how I'll continue to figure out how to get better is by, you know, reading not only journalism, but like, fiction, nonfiction books, or whatever else, like work that inspires you and makes you feel, and then trying to understand why did that make me feel so much. And, you know, trying and applying some of those things to your own writing. I would also say like not being afraid to take risks. I've definitely taken many writing risks that I look back on and feel like heavy cringe reading it, but I think like that's important. It's important to sort of try things.
The next one is from Laura Yun, also from Minneapolis. Hi, Laura. You mentioned that the Filipino teacher story was your least read piece, but the story was the most personally meaningful to you. And how do you stay positive when the web metrics, which we're focusing on a lot right now, tell you that a story is not resonating with the audience as much as you hoped? Do you guys pay attention? Sounds like you did.
Yeah, I do at least a little bit. Because it matters, you know. Like there are. It's not the only thing that matters, but I'm writing pieces that I care about, and part of caring about them is hoping that other people will see them and care about them. So it's it would be a little bit like naive for me to pretend that it doesn't matter. But it's also not the only thing, right? So stories can be successful in a lot of different ways, and that story, you know, I think, whether through emails or whatever else, I sense that it mattered deeply to a smaller number of people. And that's really meaningful too. And I think some of it is also like anything in life, sort of accepting like the things that you can control and also letting go of some of the things that you can't. And so some of the lessons to me from that story were a little bit like taking a little bit more control over trying to make sure that stories that I really cared about did find an audience. I think like, but there are also things about that you can't always control, you know, and it sometimes can be really hard to predict. I mean, I still write stories not knowing like, oh, this one is going to take off and this one is going to be a little bit quieter. Sometimes it's totally different than what you think. So also realizing that if a lot of people aren't reading it, or if you're not hearing from a lot of people, that in no way is like a reflection of the quality or like the mattering of the story itself.
One more question here, or well, actually, I guess there's still more. What are some ways to dig deeper into a story about a cultural event in your city, say a sporting event that is particular to an immigrant group? What are some ways to make it deeper than just an event story, either of you? Lane, it sounds like you're having to do those regularly.
You're in the middle of one, Lane. Sounds like you're doing it.
I'm Facebook, Eli. That was what I was trying to find. Like, who was the most, they wanted me to write something about St. Pete has the biggest gay pride event in the South and maybe the second biggest in the country. And so they were like, find a person who just puts a face on that. I mean, that was literally like a lot of my assignments now are about that. So I tried to channel you, Eli, ahead of time and do a lot of pre-reporting. You know, showing up Saturday at the parade wasn't going to cut it, you know. So I think I had a week notice, or maybe 2 weeks, just to try to find out who would be a unique way to tell the story. I think that's what I try to think about a lot of, like, if it's an event, especially that happens all the time, what haven't we told? You know, what viewpoint or what stakeholder haven't we explored on this issue? And I think finding that character who's got something at stake, like something's going to happen. The guy who was the, well, I'll just totally give it away because I didn't know until I started interviewing all these people. And that's usually a question I ask them, what's at stake, right? You're going to Pride, why? What are you worried about? What are you excited about? This guy, 25 years old, is a middle school counselor, and he's won all of these awards. He won this drag queen thing. He won Educator of the Year. He got to meet the people from Abbott Elementary to award him, like all these things. And he got to bring a plus one to the parade. And he asked his mom, you think dad would come? So it's a story about trying to see if his Chinese American dad would sit up on the float with his super flamboyant gay son and lead the parade.
It's so smart because I think the way you write stories about like big events that are cultural is you make them personal and like you make the stakes personal.
That's it. Yeah. Okay. Then somebody is saying, you talked about this, but to put a fine point on it, what's the pitch to a subject after you've done all your pre-reporting and found the person? Do you ask for the first meeting? Like, how do you approach? What's the approach, the pitch?
Yeah, sure. I think it's really different from story to story. Like, basically, I'm often trying to modulate. Once I know, like, this is the person I want to write about, it can be a little scary to people to be like, hey, I'm gonna write, like, the deepest, longest, most intimate story about you that you can possibly imagine. I want to be with you for, like, a week. I want to be there when you do all the things that you do. I'm going to be at your house when you wake up in the morning. I'll stay until you go to bed. Like, that's, for a lot of people, that's like, whoa, right? I mean, that's really, really scary. And on the flip side, it's like dishonest and setting myself up in a bad way if I suggest to somebody, this is going to be pretty quick. Like, I'm not going to ask for a lot of your time. I just, you know, it'd be great if we could talk once or twice and then we'll see how it goes. That I've tried soft pedaling it almost to that level before. And it backfires because, you know, you're constantly asking for more of somebody. It feels like you've been dishonest, and that's true. You have been dishonest. So, you know, I'm usually trying to gauge the comfort level of the person I'm writing about to sort of, you know, not scare them so much at the beginning, but at the beginning, say, basically, like, I think this matters. And what I care about is getting it right. And like, the best way to do justice to this story and to you is to make sure that I do it honestly and fully and in a way that, that reflects like the truth of it and that feels right to you and feels right to everybody who reads it. So I think that usually buys you a little bit of people understanding, like, okay, this is not going to be a quick flip thing. By the end of the reporting process, I'm asking people for their text messages, like, hey, can you send me the emails that you sent to this person? Can you, you know, like, you don't want to ask that the first time that you're talking to somebody, right? Like, that's, you want to save some of the bigger things for when they really trust you. They know you, you've been there for a while. You've sort of earned your right to ask for some of that. So I think you don't need to feel like you have to do it all at once.
I don't know if you do this, Eli, and I didn't do this as a young reporter. I didn't start doing it probably till I had kids, but like sharing a little bit of yourself. You know, you're riding in the car with this lady to Las Vegas for 2.5 hours each way. Guarantee you're going to come up and talk about your kids, right? Like, at some point in time. And I think making those connections, I used to be very hesitant to let any piece of myself out. And now I'm like, dude, I have a gay son who's exactly your age, who wanted to go to New York and be a drama. And all of a sudden, Alex and I are boom. You know, so I think if you're willing to make those connections, that helps people trust you and let you in sometimes.
Do you guys hear back from your sources after they read the stories? Like, how did your bus driver feel? How did your teacher feel?
Yeah, I almost always do hear back. You know, and there are times where those reactions change over time. Like, it can be painful at first. It can feel like exposing at first. In general, I'd say for me, the guiding rule is, like, if I'm asking people when I'm writing about them, I want them to tell me everything. I want those conversations to be as confessional as possible, et cetera, et cetera. When the story's done, it doesn't feel like the right thing to do is to, like, shut off that valve, right? Like, it's, I've been that person to them in their life for some set amount of time. And I'm not going to continue to actively try to be that person because I have another story to do and all these other things. But if they still want somebody to talk to, or if they want to stay in touch, I usually let them kind of dictate that relationship. What about you?
Lane, you're local.
Yeah, I'm Facebook friends with most everybody I write about. I mean, I kind of keep them with them through that. And it's also, you know, it's a great way to get other stories. I've gotten so many stories from people I've written about who then will be like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
It kind of just grows the whole community. There is one more question in here about, you know, it takes a lot of time and effort to report these stories. And so are there ways to substantiate their value in cultivating loyal subscribers? I mean, I think of that as engagement. Do you guys pay attention to engagement measures on your stories, or do you just have your editors trust that the stories that you're doing really are connecting with readers?
I mean, they pay attention closely to all that stuff, as I'm sure some of you, you know, who are editors on the call know. And the reassuring thing at the Post and now at the Times is knowing that these kind of stories do resonate, and the engagement times are, you know, in some cases astronomically longer than averages. They're definitely seen at the Post and at the Times as, like, very high converting stories. So, like, people subscribe more, right? Like, they convert a lot of people into subscribers as they're reading narratives, because, you know, naturally, I think if you're writing a story where there's some tension, the ending is going to be different from the beginning, people want to keep reading. And so, you know, I think that is evidenced in the numbers. It's also true that these kind of stories, to do them well, takes, like, heavy investment from newsrooms, from the journalists doing them. And that's tricky. So like, I do think we have to care a little bit that, like, they matter on like the newspaper side too, in terms of, like, readership, reputation, all this other stuff. But that's for the Post and the Times. I think that's the big piece of it too, is, like, these, you know, doing stories that people remember is the big part of building, like, a credible newsroom and a credible brand and a thing that people, like, have a relationship to. So I think it does all those things.
So on that note, you guys both had these incredible, memorable, very memorable stories, and we're really looking forward to reading more of them.
Thank you. I love seeing all of you. Take care.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, Lane.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget, you can find other episodes on pointer.org/writelane. And please join our Facebook group. This podcast was produced by Jesse Lauck. Music was composed and performed by Dan DeGregory.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.